Group meeting, Saturday, 13th April, 1985. Whenever the creative activity of the spirit effectively meets the urgency of the human situation, there is a true renewal for all who are quickened by it. They become new men and usher in a new age. Such were Lao Tzu, Krishna, the Buddha, Zarathustra, Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad, and of course those teachers who founded the Sikh religion. You see, there were 9 or 10 of them all together, and some of them were martyred by the ruling Muslim power then in India, because they are quite recent, only about 10 or 15, 10 or 12 centuries old, you see. And there were also many others, teachers, of whom history has but a dim record. Each of these who founded religions made the needed response to his own unique situation and communicated religious truth in a form which was outstandingly marked by its originality. That is that first paragraph. Although each teacher effected renewal during his lifetime only within the limited sphere of his local culture, yet so powerful was the influence of his exemplary life and the spirit manifesting through him, so profoundly true his teaching, that the gospel survived his death by many centuries and overflowed widely beyond the bounds of the land where the urgent situation originally arose. Now, with the exception of Muhammad and the Sikh teachers, they are all 20 centuries and more old. Lao Tzu flourished 26 centuries ago. Zarathustra flourished, his date is not quite certain, anything between 13 and 14 centuries ago. The Buddha lived from 562 to 483 BC. Jesus, of course, well, you know, because our calendars go by him. And Muhammad is after Jesus, 570 to 632. Now you see that with the exception of Muhammad and the Sikh teachers, all the other founders of the religions lived 20 and more centuries ago, and their influence has lived through so many centuries. For thousands of millions of people, the word of the great teachers, preserved in the scriptures of the world, has been the bread of life. In the case of the majority of people, only nominally so. In actuality, only those who were sensitive enough and sufficiently aspiring to respond to those teachings were much fewer, of course. But they have been people who have affected history for good in so many ways. To give just one simple example, Archbishop Wilberforce, who got rid of the slave trade. He was a devout Christian. And it's an interesting thing that most of the people whose work was decisive in determining the history of England during the last 10 centuries or so, about 10 centuries, were sons of ministers, and they had a strong religious bent to them. Of course, many of them made mistakes, but then who doesn't make mistakes? Even we do, don't we? Most people somehow feel in their bones what the great teachers saw perfectly, that the spirit is the root of everything. If a man's whole being may be likened to a tree, its root is the spiritual part. What is this spiritual part? You may remember I have spoken occasionally, not very often, but during the last year, that if we can see that the primordial creative energy deliberately restricting itself gives rise to grades and grades of being, grades of being on a universal scale, which means actually that we give names to those grades. The names of the archangels and the angels is one example, as well as the names of not such angelic creatures, you see. We give names to them, but actually it is the primordial creative energy itself alone functioning in different ways. Take a name like Michael, Michael, he who is like God. Take the name of Enoch, he who was the teacher, who was divine intuition, that has its counterpart in Zarathustrianism, in the holy immortal Asha. You see? Now in those days, those religious people whose sensitivities enable them to touch or be touched by these this or that particular universal energy, who are sensitive enough to be touched by it, had no option but to personalize it. Today we can talk in much more logical, rational terms, and more impersonal terms. We can talk in terms of energies and forces and this, that, and the other. In those days they couldn't. Anything which they contacted was interpreted anthropomorphically. That was inevitable. So you always had this personal God idea coming right through all the religions, you see, including Buddhism, because the term Deva, which is a Hindu term, is originally a Sanskrit word, you see. The term Deva has always been regarded as a god or a godling or something like that. But they did explain that this represented a certain power, a certain attribute of whatever was the supreme. And it was the Upanishadic teachers who really penetrated in depth completely to the supreme source possible to penetrate. For example, in the first book of the Rig Veda, it consists of 10 books. In the first book of the Rig Veda, hymn 164, you have this verse. They call it Yama, Agni, Madhrishvan, etc., etc., you see. The heavenly being, they give it these various names. These are but titles of that which is one. Now that's extremely significant, isn't it? You can see how the whole thing could have developed. So now, what we call the spirit in man is that which is essentially, which is the absolute essence of the manifestation, which is a whole human being. The essence of it is that primordial creative energy. I've said If I've said it once, I think I've said it 1,000 times during these years, that man is transcendence embodied. It's that creative energy which by deliberate self-restriction has become the total universe, and whatsoever is in the universe, and whatsoever will come to light in the future in the universe. It all emerges from that. The primordial energy holds all that in potentiality. That is what we must remember. People ask, then why is God presented as all good? How did he, if he is all good, if God is all good, how is there evil in the world and so on? Read Deuteronomy chapter 30 and see what the Lord God says to Moses. I have set before you good and evil, life and death. He is the originator of it all. And in the Zarathustrian teaching, we have the Supreme Being, God in the, for the Zarathustrians is named Ahura Mazda. Ahura Mazda created two spirits. This is how they put it in the old days. The one was the good spirit, and the other was the evil spirit. And he presented the two spirits as coterminous. They were twins. And this has been interpreted later on this way, that they were the children, if you like, of Ahura Mazda himself. But if they were the children and of Ahura Mazda, would they be immortal? Would they be eternal? No. This is where the difference came in, because this problem troubled them for over 20 centuries. And towards the end, they presented it this way. Ahura Mazda and his Holy Spirit, they identified the two, the good spirit and Ahura Mazda. They ever was, is, and ever will be. But the bad spirit, Angre Mainyu, as he is known, the bad mind, ever was, is still, but will not ever be. He will perish, you see. And of course, they made a marvelous melodrama of the perishing of the evil spirit and hell and so forth. I've spoken about it, you remember, some months ago. Now, so this spirit in us, this power of transcendence in us, is the root from which we derive all our movement, our energy, and our progress towards fulfillment. Not merely our fulfillment, but the fulfillment of this primordial creative energy as in terms of humanity, the perfect human. The same primordial creative energy presents its perfection, its transcendence in the lovely flower, in the star, in the gem, and so on. And in the human kingdom, this primordial creative energy, the origin, the source of everything, presents its transcendence as man. But each of these creations goes through an evolutionary process, a process of development, growth, fulfillment. You see? And you know how we always question, what is the purpose of our existence here? Well, one of the purposes is very definitely the fruition of the evolution of consciousness in us. Our present consciousness is isolative, separative, it's discriminative, analytic, and it splits up the unity, you see. In the Buddhist term is vijnana. The Upanishadic term for the ultimate spirit, the holistic consciousness, was Atma. And you know how in Orthodox conventional Buddhism, Atma is rejected. But they don't take any account, apparently, of a phrase which the Buddha himself used, Vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato pavam. Consciousness which is characterless, which is endless, therefore beginningless and infinite, no birth, no death, no beginning, etc., you see, everywhere shining. Now this is precisely how the Atma was presented by the Upanishadic teachers. It's a long story why this unfortunate separation between the Upanishadic presentation and the conventional Buddhist presentation came about. You know, just as you have the politics of everything, it was the politics of the survival of Hinduism as it then was in the time of the Buddha and afterwards, which brought about this sort of refusal to consider the significance of the Buddha's phrase, Vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato pavam. Consciousness, characterless, infinite, eternal, everywhere shining. Therefore, supremely knowing, consciousness in absolute perfection. And in absolute perfection for man consists in that consciousness in us which is isolative and separative, becoming all-inclusive, and what we call holistic consciousness. You see? So, the tending of the spirit is really the tending of our consciousness, living in such a way that it is released out of the shackles of vijnana, discriminative analytic consciousness, into the all-inclusive holistic consciousness. That's one of the important purposes of our existence. I can give you two or three others, but we better go on with this at the moment. If the root be held, if a man's whole being may be likened to a tree, its root is the spiritual part. If this root be healthy, a man can understand any problem confronting him. But if his inner being is afflicted, his prime need is to mend his own spirit. In all human affairs, the root crisis is spiritual and personal. That is the very root of every single problem and crisis in our individual as well as national and international lives. And this manifests itself outwardly as a material or cultural or social or international or any other crisis. Now, I said that when the situation reaches a certain state of crisis, there appears the teacher. What is the situation today? We know from our personal experience how critical the world situation is. Science, which is a cultural pursuit, as a cultural pursuit, was formerly known as natural philosophy, has risen to a status of prime importance in this century, and is now the dominant force in the life of the world. Materially, it has enabled man to establish a technological age. It has put within his grasp, manipulable power great enough to destroy all life and even to turn this planet, the Earth, our mother whom he knows not how to honor, into a dazzling explosion, bright enough to give some distant astronomer in a distant age, on a distant planet, in a distant solar system, a passing thrill. He'll see this explosion if we do it. Contrarywise, man could use this vast knowledge and power in the service of the good, if only he understood what is the real good. And he could use it not only to fulfill the unfolding pattern of his own being, but also to serve the other children of Mother Earth, the animals and the plants and the very soil on which he lives. He is Lord here. It is his bounden duty to exercise dominion, which means not in human destructive exploitation of everything, but the parental responsibility of nurturing and sustaining with loving wisdom. You find in the first chapter of Genesis, for instance, it distinctly stated that the Lord God, having created all these things, finally gave man dominion over the whole creation. Now, what does dominion mean? Dominus, the Lord, the house Lord, a word which is used in the Pali scriptures, house Lord, is the one who protects, who nurtures, who sustains, who brings to fruition. That is the Lord, not somebody who dominates or exercises or does harm to other creations, including man, of course. Now, I'm afraid there are very few house lords who can really be classed be regarded as belonging to the true Lord of the house, the true, exercising true dominion. There are very few. Now, I said that science has brought in the technological age. Now, our present world crisis is due very considerably to this mastery of technology which man has acquired. You know the history of man. Every invention, practically every invention from ages past, was first used for destruction. Take a stone, and when man made that stone into a little axe or whatever he needed, what did he use it for? For killing, for destroying. Well, he had to hunt, that is true, in order to find his food. But then he had to do that because he was just emerging out of the animal stage. Anatomical man, similar to in structure to our anatomy, is only about 40,000 years old. He came into being after the Neanderthals. Our ancestry goes back about 40,000 years as such. Prior to that, the anatomy was man, and the anatomy of man was different, developing over a period of 45 million years right from the very beginnings, you see, through stage after stage, passing through what we call, Ramapithecus, Shivapithecus, Australopithecus, and then the first bipedal man who flourished in Africa, and so forth. And then we come to Homo erectus, and the drawings which are made of the possible appearance of Homo erectus are really quite amusing in a way. He looked rather animalish, really, you see. And the fact that we could walk on 2 feet made a very big difference to our capacity to deal with our circumstance and with nature, because it left the hands free to make tools. And the making of tools played one of the most important parts in the evolution of the human constitution and the brain, which of course bore within it the influence of its descent from the reptiles and mammals, and then that mammalian group which consisted of the primates. And the most important of the primates turned out to be man as such. So all these things should be borne in mind when we look into this. And it was only about 6,000-8,000 years ago, somewhere there, that this idea of caring, of love, of cooperation and so on came into being. And we are still trying to live by it, not with very much success, excepting amongst the few. We are all right, of course. Modern science has radically changed the conception of the nature of things. Now, this is an extremely important point, the conception of the nature of things, because through the ages, from the time when man first began to get ideas about human life and behavior and what human destiny was and so forth, that was all transmitted orally. And language, afterwards, with the development of writing, language put into writing its conceptions of progress and development and the way man should live. Now, all concept and word, concepts, conceiving and verbalizing, depends completely upon our knowledge of the nature of things. We talked about a simple example, how in the past a man anthropomorphized everything. He had only knowledge in terms of himself and his fellow human beings and so forth. Now, as the knowledge of the nature of things changed, the expressions of man's perceptions with regard to the transcendent, with the divine, to that which is beyond him and so forth, all changed accordingly. Round about the 6th and 5th centuries BC, the great thinkers in China, India and in Greece produced the atomic theory. Now, of course, their atomic theory was nothing like our modern scientific atomic theory, but it had its points. To give you one very interesting example, what we in modern science call valency, and the combination of the atoms of one element with another. To give the simplest possible example, 2 atoms of hydrogen combined with 1 of oxygen to give a molecule of water, you see. So that prevailed, the idea of valency prevailed in India in the 5th and 4th centuries BC. But they talked in terms of atoms of earth, air, fire, water. you see. The Greeks did not improve very much on that. But the Greeks certainly played a very great part in the development of scientific investigation and the nature of scientific investigation. They collected information and classified it. Aristotle was really the father of all that. He and his school and his pupils. Now, having done that, Aristotle sat in his armchair and speculated as to what sort of laws in nature bring all this about. And of course, all his speculations, well, perhaps not everyone, but most of them were just sheer nonsense. He was able to prove that if you took a lump of iron and a handful of feathers to the top of the house and dropped them, you see, the iron would reach the earth first. Of course, if we try the experiment, we will find that the lump of iron will reach the earth first. But Aristotle knew nothing about the dynamics of the whole situation, the resistance offered by the air to feathers. You see, it's very different from the resistance offered by the air to the lump of iron. So naturally, the lump of iron gets down to the earth much quicker than the handful of feathers. So all that. Finally, Aristotle died in 323 BC, I think, somewhere there, or 322, I forget. Aristotle died then, but when Roger Bacon in England, and after him Francis Bacon, a couple of century or two later, came on the scene, then experimental science in the real sense began to develop. And nowadays, of course, we have a totally different conception of all things and the way nature works. I'm not going to suggest that we have found the ultimate. We haven't. There is no end to the discovery of truth. No one has ever had or has today a monopoly of truth. The Hindus recognized this. They said no one has any monopoly of truth, but they were referring to religion. And we know what awful wars have taken place in the name of religion, because people have intolerantly and rigidly said, ours is the truth, the ultimate truth, yours is false, you see. You'll go to hell, and unless you become one of us and get baptized and all the rest of the ablutionary nonsense, you will burn forever. Well, as for me, I would prefer to be warm forever than... Anyhow, now, sufficiently radical changes in the conception of the nature of things necessitate corresponding changes in both thought and action in other fields. To cite but one example from the past, the first Roman Catholic theology, that of St. Augustine of Hippo in the early 5th century, accepted and utilized the scientific conceptions of Democritus and Plato. Aristotle, who was Plato's most brilliant pupil, disagreed with these. Give you one example. The Democritus, in the Platonic theory, they said you could divide a length into half, and that into half, and so on, you see. But Aristotle pointed out that Plato and Democritus said that you finally come to the atom, which is the ultimate end. And Aristotle said, no, it's certainly not the ultimate end, because I can conceive of endless division. You see, but of course, these were both conceptual things. They had no physical reality. And on that ground, Aristotle raised up a different deduced many things which were different from the Platonic philosophy. Arabian and Jewish scholars who took for granted the physics and philosophy of Aristotle so influenced Catholic scholars after the Muslim entry into Spain that the Roman Church was deeply shocked by the acceptance of Aristotelian as against Platonic science by men like Abelard. He's the priest who was of Abelard and Heloise fame. It's a very sad story. And you know, Dante chucked both of them into Inferno, suffering horrible torments. Turn it off. That's it. That's off. Thank you. Abelard, his date is approximately 1079 to 1142. The other person was Albertus Magnus, who was a very important person. He was the teacher of St. Thomas Aquinas. Albertus Magnus, his date of birth is uncertain. They think it is 1193, and he lived to 1280. Nice long life. Albertus Magnus, and then 8.5 centuries after St. Augustine, St. Thomas Aquinas, who was a pupil of Albertus Magnus, produced his theology. The date of St. Thomas Aquinas, both dates are uncertain, 1225 to 1274. Not a very long life, but he produced an immense amount of theological stuff. St. Thomas Aquinas, having mastered Aristotle's physical and psychological writings, made use of them for his Summa Theologica, which was accepted finally by the Roman Church as the basis of its theological position. Now remember, the Roman Church started with the Augustinian philosophy. St. Augustine of Hippo produced his theology. Augustine lived between 354 and 430 AD. You see? So it was about 8.5 centuries afterwards that Thomas Aquinas produced the second theology, which was necessitated by the study of the Aristotelian ideas of the nature of things, and his researchers, he and his pupils' researchers, into psychological and other questions like that. It's a very fascinating study, you know, actually, but it needs a lifetime. Now, the interesting point is this, for me particularly. It is said that when St. Thomas Aquinas had produced the 12 volumes of the Summa Theologica and had begun writing the 13th, he had the divine vision and he just stopped writing. You see, he was a practicing mystic. A friend, a very close friend, one day came and talked with him. And Aquinas said to him, "All that I've written is rubbish." Well, we've been trying to see what rubbish the religions have produced about heaven and hell and your immortal soul and the battle between God and his angels and Satan and his devils and all the rest of that rubbish, you see. Ultimately, in centuries to come, we shall be free of all these speculative setups. Free of them altogether. We shall be able to see for ourselves and know for ourselves. I think we'll stop there today. Now, we have done a page and a half. Now, there's one very interesting thing historically. In each succeeding age where the urgent situation arises, it always becomes more and more intense and more menacing. You see why? As the knowledge of science increases and man's control over the energies of nature increases, and simultaneously his morality and his intelligence, his real intelligence, his spiritual intelligence does not grow sufficiently, the destruction of man and the world becomes a greater and a greater possibility. That is why it is an imperative necessity for people like ourselves to try and help our whole environment. Each of us, after all, has only a small environment. To help our whole environment to undergo a metanoia, you see, and to repent, that is, turn away from, pento pentere, I turn away from, you see, to turn away from that which is untrue, which is unloving, ugly, bad, and so on, you see. But there is something, a point in connection with this which you must always remember. We cannot act and should never act as militant evangelists. You only make the other person antagonistic that way. Usually, the method of fear has been tried for practically 4,000 years now. The method of fear, you'll go to hell. Has it worked? Man is sufficiently in hell and hellish today, after 6,000 years of development, material development. This is where religion in the real sense comes in, to live the good life. And it isn't easy, is it? I know how many million times I fail before I succeed in two or three. What's the psychological process? The process of thought and feeling and reaction to every stimulus that comes up or to every memory that rises up from within. And that is the golden way to self-knowledge, most wonderfully expounded by the Buddha and emphasized by him, more than any of the other teachers. watch. In Christianity, Jesus said, watch and pray. What do you watch? TV? Traffic in Piccadilly Circus? Watch what goes on there all the time. And pray. To pray means to be in communion with. Not to say, dear God, please send me this, that or the other. God won't do that. If there were a personal, separate God, He won't do it because He's God. He's not man. Then the Christian said, God became man in Jesus, the one and only man. You see all the muddlement and confusion, dreadful confusion in the heart and the mind of the human race yet. It is when transcendence within the particular aspires to and expresses with right conduct that aspiration, that transcendence on the universal scale naturally responds. Not knowingly, this statement, God heard my prayer, is sheer rubbish. He must be a marvelous linguist, you know. There are people in, how many languages are there in the world? Hundreds of languages, aren't there? He must be knowing all these languages. What a clever chap. But he wasn't clever enough to prevent evil. And he had to confess, I have set before you good and evil, life and death. It's a case of caring for that which is worthwhile caring about. Yourself to start with. Love thy neighbor as thou lovest thyself. But how will you be able to love your neighbor if you can't love yourself? The true self, the real, the reality in you. The reality is transcendence. And it manifests dually, that's the trouble. The good and the evil, and it's fixed in our brains at the present stage of the evolution of the brain. The reptilian brain and the exclusively mammalian caring aspect of the brain. The mammals did an excellent thing. They brought in the element of caring for the young. That was the origin of the development of love and friendly relationships and all that. The reptiles didn't have it. And that came about because the mammals gave birth to live young. The reptiles laid eggs, didn't they? And it was out of the egg that the reptiles came.